This week, we welcome Jess Burns, Senior Analyst at Forrester Research, to discuss Forrester's top security program recommendations for 2022. In the Leadership and Communications section, what cybersecurity metrics should I report to my board? Cybersecurity litigation risks, four top concerns for CISOs, the SEC is about to force CISOs into America's boardrooms, and more. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Weekly.
Monitoring and maintaining compliance is a never-ending struggle with a high price of failure. FireMon helps customers meet complex and varying compliance requirements. FireMon has fully customizable reporting, analytics, assessments, and dashboards to meet the compliance needs of any organization. With FireMon, compliance reports take a tenth of the time, and real-time continuous compliance eliminates the anxiety and headaches of audit preparation. Improve security outcomes by improving security operations with FireMon. Visit securityweekly.com/FireMon to learn more. It's time to rethink how we approach cybersecurity, because the reality is, modern cyber attackers are already past your initial defenses. ExtraHop helps your security team find and eradicate advanced threats before real damage is done. Protect your enterprise and customers with better defense. Learn more about how ExtraHop stops advanced threats at securityweekly.com/ExtraHop. That's extra, H-O-P. Cybercriminals are working overtime. Last year in the fourth quarter alone, phishing attacks disguised as COVID testing information increased by 521%. Barracuda has identified 13 types of email threats and how cybercriminals use them to steal money from your company or personal information from your employees and customers. Find out about the 13 email threat types and how Barracuda can provide complete email protection for your teams, your customers, and your reputation. Get your free ebook at securityweekly.com/Barracuda. That's securityweekly.com/Barracuda.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 260, recorded April 25th, 2022. I am your host, Matt Alderman, in the Lone Star Studio. Yes, see, I got it. It's all here in Texas. Joining remotely are my co-hosts. First, welcome back from PTO, Mr. Jason Albuquerque.
Hey there, Matt. Thanks. Back from Washington, D.C. A little bit of excitement over the weekend, but all in all, great trip with the family.
Great to have you back. Also joining me from the great state of Texas is Mr. Ben Carr. Oh, he's muted.
Helps if I go off a mute. I said a little less remote than we used to be. Glad to be back with you here today in a nice rainy day in Austin.
Rainy and cool. Yes, it is. I don't wear the quarter zip often in Texas, but it's cool today. Security Weekly listeners save $100 off your RSA Conference 22 full conference pass. RSA Conference will be live in San Francisco June 6th to 9th, 2022. Security Weekly will be there in full force, delivering real-time live coverage and interviewing some of the top event speakers and sponsors. To register using our discount code, please visit securityweekly.com/RSAC2022 and use the code 52UCYBER. Hope to see you there. Do you have any specific guests or topics that you want us to cover on one of the shows? Submit your suggestions for guests by visiting securityweekly.com/guests and complete the form. We review those suggestions often and we'll reach out to you once reviewed. Jess Burns is a senior analyst at Forrester, serving security and risk professionals. She contributes to Forrester's research on the role of the CISO and Zero Trust. Additionally, Jess covers email security, incident response and crisis management, and security training, education, and certifications. Prior to her analyst role, Jess spent 8 years as a principal advisor on Forrester Security and Risk Council. In this role, she was a trusted partner to a network of CISOs and security and risk leaders, making critical decisions in the areas of risk management, data privacy and protection, cybersecurity operations, and identity and access management. Jess, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Thank you so much for having me today. Happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great. We love to bring the analysts on, especially when they have these great little reports that we can share tidbits and insights to the community and help them build a better security program. Before we get into some of the topics, Jess, give us kind of a little background on the foundations, kind of the thought process behind this initial report around these top security recommendations.
Yeah. Great. So this is an annual report. We've been doing this, gosh, for at least 8 years or so. And so this, along with our predictions for every year, and then also our top threats reports, are things that we do as a team every year. So every year we sit down and do a brainstorming session about what we've heard from the hundreds and hundreds of conversations we've had with security leaders and security practitioners, as well as the security tech community over the course of a year, and sort of distill that into what we think that security leaders should be thinking about for the year to come. So that's really what we do for our program recommendations every year. And this year, we decided to really focus and theme out the spotlight that CISOs have right now. They've had it now. It's been gaining and getting brighter and brighter for the last couple of years. But, you know, there's a moment in time now where there's a lot of goodwill, I think. If you've made it through 2020, and good Lord, you made it through 2021 as well, you've got some access, you've got some influence, and you're able to make an impact on the organization by helping them go to market as a trusted business. So we're trying to basically say to folks, what are you going to do with your one wild and precious moment of spotlight? You know, use it for good. And we have these 8 recommendations for you.
And we talk a lot about aspects of all of these 8. And so I want to start with one that we talk about a lot, and that is about trust. Add trust to your role and title. You know, trust, we think, is a very important component of, I think, any security leadership role, especially for the CISO, right? How do you establish trust? How do you build trust with the organization and then use that to build and craft a great security program? Where does the role move? You say add it to the title. Jason will say this, if you don't talk about risk, you'll report to the chief risk officer, right? Same thing for trust. If you don't distill trust or build trust, does that mean you report to the chief trust officer? Is that where this role potentially goes?
To me, I think it's time that we get to the CEO, and I think we'll get there, probably not in 2022, but when you're looking at going to market on trust and becoming part of a trusted business, this goes into product security, this goes into enterprise security, and this is really just providing the backbone for the business to move forward. So we were just sitting down with some CISOs last week, and many folks are already doing this, right? They're out there, they're listening to customers, they're trying to make sure that employee productivity isn't bogged down by a lot of friction. And so it's really about moving the business forward. And I think now that CISOs are in front of the board alone without the CIO, I think it's time for them to kind of formally come out of that shadow. And with adding trust to the title, our feeling is that it's time to go to the CEO level. Love to hear your thoughts, though.
And Jess, one of the things throughout the course of my career, you know, I truly feel, and Matt hit on it, you know, trust is the foundation of all the relationships that I've built. It's the foundation of influence with other business leaders. But ultimately, it was about listening and learning the business. So building that connection with business leaders across the entire organization, learning their business, learning what motivates them, learning what they envision their journey and their strategies to be, and really aligning to that. As you started having conversations with other CISOs and you really dug in to add trust to the role, you know, how did some CISOs kind of start down that path of building trust? Because trust isn't something that you flip a switch and make happen. It takes time.
No, absolutely. It's a very purposeful effort to go and meet with the business. And the reports we've put out before, we have a first 90 days as a CISO. And whether you've been in the role, you're new there for your first 90 days, or whether you've been there for 5 years, you need to get out and get in front of the business. you can reboot as if you're brand new and go start building those relationships and having those conversations, because change is made one conversation at a time between a successful CISO and business leaders. You know, I've seen people also bring in BISO roles, right, to make sure that there's an ongoing, because the CISO is just one person, this ongoing relationship where you've got somebody there in the BU management team that's constantly thinking about security and what, how that applies to decisions being made at the business unit level. So it, it is a very purposeful thing that needs to be done, especially customers too, getting out in front of it. I've known a lot of CISOs that have made or broken deals based on what they've said to customers, you know, and they've won over competitors just because of the ability for the CISO to demonstrate superior security in their products and services as well.
Yeah, Jess, I think that's so important. I mean, you're kind of echoing the playbook I'm trying to run, right? So my role has evolved. Like, I started off as the CISO with the company I'm with now, but, you know, very quickly we you know, moved and evolved that title to Chief Security and Trust Officer. And, you know, working to bring on a BISO right now, right? I really believe in that, you know, pushing security out into the business, making it kind of transparent and part of the normal function. I think that's really, really key. You know, CISOs have to become business leaders to the organization and manage that risk. So I think you're right on target with that. I would be interested in how you see that role to be so evolving over time. Like, where do you see functionally that bringing the most value to the organization?
Yeah, I just published a role profile on Abiso recently. My colleague Jeff Pollard and I did, because I'm such a big believer in that role. And, you know, I've seen it work really well for years in financial services and insurance, right? So I think about like a MassMutual where they've got Abiso embedded in the data science team, right? And the BISO acts as this, is constantly thinking about customer trust when they're thinking about how to use specific data, right? And I think that's really incredible. So you're acting as a way to enable the business, a role that enables the business, but you're also thinking about all the things that are the backbone of the trusted business regulations, you know, privacy, and just data use in general that keeps customer trust intact. So I think the BISO role is, one, it's a great feeder if you want to do succession planning for the CISO. CISO should be developing people that they think can ultimately replace them if they have a different exit strategy. And I think, you know, they should be thought of as mini CISOs within those business units, but then with a reporting up and a lot of shared communication between the BISOs, so everybody has a really great picture about, you know, how security is aligning with corporate objectives.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, we were debating that role a few weeks ago on the show, actually. Jess had my original take too, Ben. I'm just saying.
I think it depends upon the size of the org, right? So I think she's right. Like, in a financial services organization or an organization that's large and has different business operating units, I think that does align more to that. But I think in smaller, mid-sized organizations, the way I've used it, and, you know, for your comment, Jess, is we've used it kind of to bring in people who are maybe outside of security, but have a real connection to the business. So from a like sales engineer leader or you know, something like that, to come in and kind of run and organize the security and privacy champions to develop those areas of the business, but then use that to give them experience and exposure into other areas of security where they can kind of then spread out and figure out where they evolve into.
Yeah, that's dead on, Ben. I mean, I did the same thing, right? Not, you know, in an emerging enterprise organization where we really didn't have the budget to hire a bunch of security professionals. We went out there and evangelized the program and got what we called cyber warriors. And they were folks embedded in the business who had another role, but ended up aligning with security. And then little by little started getting that influence. And then, you know, their focus starts to become cybersecurity for the organization and privacy and data protection and really evolving it that way. So from within the departments themselves, getting folks who are interested in aligning and working with us.
Yep. Yeah, that's a great feeder, especially if you look at some really good developer security champions. I think those roles are huge because that's such a big part of oftentimes product security. And if you've got someone that understands how to speak both of those languages, you've got the makings of a great BISO and maybe a future CISO ahead of you. You never know.
Agreed.
Correct. Yeah. So I'm going to go to treat security staff for what it is, different, because I think it aligns a little bit to this building trust, right? I mean, you also have to build your team. Trust is a big proponent, a big component of that, right? You have to, you know, hire people that you trust. You want to instill that trust on them. And I think a lot of CISOs struggle with this. You know, building out the staff is difficult in this day and age. How, as a CISO, do you, you know, continue to staff up your teams and instill that same level of trust across the organization?
Yeah. So I'll start. So this is one where I think relationships count too. And in this case, it might be the relationship with HR. So when the pandemic was in full swing, I remember speaking to CISOs saying, I cannot seem to get HR to understand that I need to blow up our geographic requirements for these specific positions. I don't care. I'm looking for the top talent. And I think that's an important thing when people have decided to sort of up and move wherever it is that they feel most comfortable. That plays into it. And I think, you know, people have been saying the great resignation, but in security, and I'm sure you guys can relate to this, it's really just a great reshuffle because people have gone somewhere else. They haven't left the workforce. They just went somewhere else that was more in line with their values and more in line with what it is that they're looking for from a career. And what we've seen oftentimes in places that have had a lot of attrition is that it's not so much the money, but it's the lack of a clear path forward within that organization. So I've been a big proponent of things like succession planning when you think about retention, because people need to know, what's my next move and how can I start getting ready for that now? And how can you invest in me? And how can I see that you're investing in me in a development path for me to go from a SOC analyst to an incident responder, for example, or maybe from an incident responder already all the way to a security operations manager, should that happen? So I think letting people know that they're valued and that there's a place for them moving forward in the organization is big. And then back to HR, you've kind of got to blow up some of those hiring practices, be it geography, it could be bachelor's degree requirements, it could be, you know, making sure that you don't tune your software, your recruiting software so much that you're just filtering out absolutely everybody that doesn't have every cert in a book. You know, there are things that need to be done to make sure that you're bringing in people in the pipeline at the entry level and then keeping those folks that you really want to keep around. So I'd love to hear what's happening, you know, in practice in your organization.
That's absolutely music to my ears. I mean, number one, it's, you know, diversify the workforce and pull those constraints that old school HR has put around security roles, right? And really diversify that pool that you can look at. One of my success stories is that I have an incredible security manager right now who started off as a business analyst, right? And just had the attitude, had the aptitude, wanted to learn, you know, started at the entry level from a security perspective and really picked up steam and now is an incredible, you know, senior manager in a cybersecurity team. It's really looking outside the box and looking for that attitude and aptitude, building a bench, you know, doing things like apprenticeship programs so you can build a bench. I think that's where we're going to be successful. Just break those chains of traditional HR hiring practices.
Yeah, and I'll jump in and add that I think, you know, I echo what you've said and what Jason said, but I think to, you know, highlight on a different point that you brought up, I think the transparency and the communication and giving people kind of a roadmap for their career, right? Echoing like, what do they need to do? I mean, I've gone into a lot of organizations where the mantra that titles don't matter. There's a certain truism to that, but I think people want to see, like, how do I get from step A to step B, right? How do I get to a career path? How do I get to a career goal? And I think, you know, partnering with HR is a great idea. I think HR has been kind of this disconnected entity from many parts of the organization. I think, you know, security leveraging that to do both training, awareness, making sure you're staying in touch with the vibe and the culture of the company and how to best articulate the message of security and make it part of everyone's job, but as well trying to figure out how to utilize HR to get, you know, benefits to the program. So how do you handle hiring? How do you make that connection from a relationship perspective so you can do things like say, hey, I don't care where somebody is, right? Hey, the numbers that we're showing for salaries for these roles aren't in line with what we're seeing from market. How do we get that quicker updated so we're not going off of something that was established 5 years ago and is no longer a truism? So I think that's a really good point, is to look for areas of the organization, and HR is a good example, where you really need to partner to figure out how to excel in your program.
And it's not just cybersecurity, folks. It's everywhere. We struggle with this every single day on the media side of the house. You know, yes, we focus on cybersecurity, but I don't necessarily need a CISO or a full-blown cybersecurity executive in here either. And it's tough in any business, I think, to recruit and find the right talent. So I think these tips are important across the board. This next one, I love this next one. See government as a source of good in cybersecurity for once. And I think a lot of this has to do with zero trust, Jess, and the administration's move to push the agencies to zero trust. Now, we just finished zero trust research that I presented last month. And although it's a big topic in the federal government, we don't see the same adoption on the commercial side. So the commercial side's a little slower to this than an executive order from the federal government. But I do agree with you that the government has done some good here in laying out the components of a zero trust architecture that we in the industry can learn off of.
Yeah, absolutely. And what we're telling people to do is use this, right? Use this to your advantage right now. And I've seen people do this, right? They're going up to the board, they're going to their peers in IT operations, they're going to CIOs and saying, look, this is an example of a mandate and this is going to happen. The government's taking this on. We can too. In fact, there was a Canadian, it's a Crown Energy company up in Canada that I spoke to recently that is actually using the US government's mandate to push their own zero trust efforts forward because you're seeing this as an example of adoption. And I think what the private sector sometimes doesn't realize is that they're doing a good number of things that fall into the zero trust framework, be it NIST or be it Foresters. You know, they're already doing things like MFA and PAM, and they're doing microsegmentation, and they've got SOAR working, they've got security analytics happening. You know, so it's really helping people understand that this is not, you know, a complete rip and replace, which I think is sometimes the fear for private sector. They're fearing that there's just going to be too much cost and too much change. There might be a fair amount of change, but I wouldn't say there's necessarily going to be a lot of heavy tech investment. It's really doing what you're already doing, but, you know, optimizing the processes around it. So that was the zero trust piece for it. There's a hiring aspect to this too, because as you know, the government blew up the salary bans for cybersecurity talent. That's going to mean that folks who had never have ever gone to a government agency before could leave you for them. So once again, all those things we just talked about come into play as well.
Yeah, I think the best thing for me that the zero trust architecture did was really help people identify the core pillars of the zero trust architecture. Because you're right. People, organizations are doing a lot of the components. They're doing aspects of identity. They're doing stuff on the device side with their endpoints, network, applications, and the data side, right? But it's having laid out kind of a vision of when we talk zero trust, these are the components of zero trust. Because the problem with zero trust in the early days, and I think we still have a little bit of this, is it zero trust on the network side or zero trust only on the identity side? No. Zero trust has to cover all five of these core domains. So don't just think about zero trust in one of those pillars. You got to start thinking across the five pillars. And I think that was some of the best education that the industry could have received from the federal government.
Totally agree on that. Yeah. So we just published a definition of modern zero trust where, you know, I will admit as a long-term forester, this term came from us, right? My esteemed former colleague, John Kindervag. But then it sort of ran away from us and we have 20 page papers on aspects of zero trust, but not a distinct, succinct definition. So I would encourage folks to go and check that out. A blog post from my colleague David Holmes has the full definition in it in front of the paywall. And it is a framework. And to do zero trust, you must do all of it. And I think the tech industry, to their credit now, is understanding that their messaging should be, we enable this pillar of zero trust, not we are zero trust. And I think that's actually helping reduce the confusion as well, because everyone is saying, this is what we do. And we help in this space. So people are now understanding, okay, this isn't one monolithic thing that I have to do all at once. We can do this iteratively, and we can continue to make progress for the positive in our organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. Last one we're going to cover probably, because that's all we have time for, is pay down your vulnerability debt now. Now, We talk about this also on the show around aspects of security and technical debt and the challenges with that. Why now? What allows us to start to pay this down now? Because if I think about it, it's probably gotten a little harder, right? Because we went to cloud, we went to remote workers. Like, we just took what was a pretty easy environment potentially to secure and kind of expanded it. Why now? Isn't it harder to pay down that debt?
It probably is harder to pay down that debt given the sprawl that happens with cloud. And I'm actually a big fan of things like attack surface management to help people know what it is that they have out there. But really, this was that goodwill moment where we said, this is the time, right? Everybody's still reeling a bit from Log4j in a sense that it became a critical emergency for almost every company. And to realize that you need to sit there and systematically look at the vulnerability that you have and prioritize it. Now is just the time to use that goodwill, to use the sort of concern now that IT ops may have not had before, but they have now after having gone through Log4j, to just start looking at things and everybody getting on the same page. Because where I still see a lot of conflict is between the security team and the IT ops team, the people who govern and the people who execute. To me, there's still a lot of friction there. And, you know, we're hoping that this is a time for CISOs to use that influence that we've been talking about. And the theme of this whole paper is use that influence now to make some real progress on vulnerability debt.
And it's not just IT ops, it's DevOps too, Jess. I mean, sure. If you think about where we see friction, it's friction between the security teams and the DevOps teams. You know, some of the DevOps teams are taking on more of the infrastructure components now. So they're replacing aspects of IT ops. So we've also created more operational teams that we also have to work with and reduce friction to get and to pay down some of this debt.
Yeah, absolutely. And that all has to do, you know, very much with product security as well.
Right. Yeah. Product security was mentioned on here. I think the other one just quickly to mention was around preparing for critical vulnerability response, right? I think, again, Log4j created a little bit of a crisis. Do we have our incident response plans in place? Can we respond quickly to events? Those are, you know, a couple other key areas that came out of this report.
Yeah, and this again was where the government is also a source of good, because CISA put out some excellent playbooks for folks that maybe don't have the resources to do that themselves. Not only do they have an IR playbook for small to medium-sized businesses, which was heavily contributed to by the larger private sector organizations, there's also a vulnerability response playbook. And we're advocating that you really treat this like an IR team. You create that team, it's a cross-functional team, and you put it through its paces on a critical vulnerability response. And you do drills similarly to what you do, tabletops and everything else, that you do for your typical IR plan and playbooks.
Yeah, agreed. Jason, Ben, any additional questions for Jess while we have her?
No, good to go from my side. I appreciate the insight and you know, getting the information out to the masses, because you're absolutely right. You know, we need to start using these frameworks, using these best practices that you know, that CISA's putting out, the government's putting out, and really use it as a framework to move our businesses forward.
Ben? Yeah, agree. No, totally agree. I thought, yeah, you're kind of right on spot with that. So I agree with a lot of the points that you brought up, and think that they're great focus areas.
Jess, thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly.
Pleasure to be here. Come back anytime.
You got it. With that, we're going to take a quick break and cover the leadership and communications articles for this week.
Cyber risk and compliance automation is finally here. Legacy GRC systems cannot support the powerful, real-time automation and oversight that organizations require to take risks that matter to succeed. CyberSync continuous control automation ingests data from the IT GRC stack to update controls against regulatory requirements and risks in real time, delivering insights and visibility. See how members of the Fortune 500 are saving millions annually by visiting securityweekly.com/CyberSync. Account takeovers, malicious campaigns, impersonation, and data breaches are on the rise, driven by the pandemic and security challenges of a remote workforce. The number one most common attack vector in breaches is compromised credentials. Constella Intelligence protects your key employees from digital risk by continuously monitoring the deep, dark, and surface web for exposed credentials, detecting threats that others miss with real-time alerts to protect you and your company from a targeted attack. Try it free at securityweekly.com/Constella. Endpoint security is designed to protect every device in your fleet, wherever it may be. These days, that can be a lot of different places. Find out how HP Wolf Security uses emerging strategies like application isolation, along with a zero-trust approach and framework to give you a powerful, manageable, usable solution to your growing and increasingly spread-out security challenges. Learn how HP Wolf Security can make a difference across your endpoints at securityweekly.com/HP Wolf.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Jason Albuquerque and Ben Carr. Don't miss any of your favorite Security Weekly content. Visit securityweekly.com/subscribe to subscribe to any of our podcast feeds and have all new episodes downloaded right to your phone. You can also join our mailing list, Discord server, and follow us on social media and our streaming platforms. Join Paul Asadorian and Rich Mogul on May 4th to learn how to choose the right architecture for your application. Live attendees at this webcast will have the chance to win a $100 Hacker Warehouse gift card. Register at securityweekly.com/webcast. And don't forget to check out our library of on-demand webcasts by visiting securityweekly.com/on-demand. All right. Well, we just finished a segment with Forrester, and the first two articles come from Gartner, both by Paul Proctor, by the way. I spent a lot of time in, when I was on the vendor side briefing Mr. Proctor because I spent a lot of time on the governance, risk management, and compliance side, which he covered for Gartner during that span. The first one talks about value is missing from communications. And there's a line in here, Jason, I just have to read this because it's such a good, like, to me, it's just like the best summary ever. He says, I spent 5 years as chief of research for risk and security at Gartner, but 6 years ago, I left that role to join the finance team in the CIO group. Now, why would a security guy join the finance team? Because it all comes back to money and value.
I literally just snorted as I laughed under my breath because I have it right here on my OneNote. I wish I could take a screenshot and show everybody. It's literally the top line and I have it in all capitals, right? It is. At the end of the day, if you want to influence the CEO, if you want to influence the CFO, if you want to influence the services team, the board, it's going to be about value add. It's going to be about money coming into the business. It's going to be about how do we support revenue, right? How are we impacting the P&L? That's what it's going to come down to. And I put a note in here, you know, we're going to talk about this in the next article about some of these metrics. I always aligned those more tactical, technical metrics to ways and value that I was able to assist and closing winning opportunities for our business, right? We're in a services-oriented business, IT services. So how do I align to opportunities that are won for our organization? And it can come in many fashions. The team can be on a risk management call with a customer that we're trying to onboard, a net new prospect customer, and they're face-to-face with the security team of that customer. And they won't do business with us unless we can pass that risk assessment, right? It's conversations like that. And one of the things I made sure our team always did is tag those opportunities that we had a hand in influencing in Salesforce. Always, always, always. And now you're looking at a team who, over the course of a quarter, could have influenced 14 million, 20 million in revenue for the organization because we were able to pass go. We made it past the security team or the risk team that had a hard, fast mantra, we won't do business with you unless you meet our standards.
Yep. Yeah, he talks about business value and value-based metrics and non-value-based metrics. And then the second article, he actually talks about five metrics, and we'll get there in a second. But one of the metrics in that five is know which risky third parties you're engaged with, to your point, right? Like, this is a metric now that people are tracking. If you can't become the business partner to the organization to help them secure other business, then you're missing the value proposition for what you can do in that CISO role. And you've done it so well in your career, Jason. Mm-hmm. You are a great example of how security can drive value and to drive revenue for the business, because you've proven it over and over again.
Yeah, exactly it. And, you know, that's where those more tactical metrics, and it's an education process, right? I mean, my first 6 months a year as a CISO to an enterprise IT services organization, I'm not talking to the CEO about time to remediate incidents. I'm educating them on what this means. I'm educating them on, you know, the senior leadership team and the board on the importance of vulnerability management and the patching cadence and all of that. And you know, once they're educated on those metrics, now I can say, see, by us keeping all of these items tight and having good metrics and the ability to show our customers that we're executing on these items, this drives revenue. It allows us to do business with organizations who don't have the risk appetite to not do these vendor risk assessments, or have high expectations of their IT services organization, you know, from a compliance and a risk management perspective, and educating them that, and again, speaking to the IT services business, we ultimately have the keys to the castle to the majority of the infrastructure and technology within an organization's environment. Why wouldn't we be under scrutiny? Why wouldn't we want to have all of our program tight, right? And be able to articulate that to customers.
And I think that comes back to, we talked about on the call with Jess there. I think it comes back to that trust quotient, right? Thinking about it more as how you externalize this and how you create transparency for the organization and alignment that you're doing the things that your customers want you to do. And then now you can really start to come back and articulate value and say, how did I shorten the cycle for sales, right? Whether you're in IT services delivery or whether you're making widgets, right? Like, everybody's having to do third-party risk assessments right now. And so as part of that, if you can externalize that, make it transparent, make it easy for customers to get to, and you can say, hey, I pulled that back from a 6 or a 3 month process into a 24-hour process just to deliver that information as transparently as possible, you've moved the bubble from a sales perspective. So now you've started to generate that alignment, that trust internally, right? So it's about that two function of internal and external trust that as a CISO, you really have to build.
Yeah. I mean, you know you're winning when you have leaders in the organization call on you to get on conversations with customers, whether it's an escalation conversation, a pre-sales conversation, trying to help from a business value with a partner. You know, when you're involved in those conversations, you know you're influencing the business. But I will say this, don't go at it with an ego. We're going to talk a little bit later on about skills that CIOs and IT leaders need. One of them is vulnerability. And I would be 100% lying if I went in front of customers who had risk assessments and we always 100% hit the mark on every single control that they expected us to hit. No, it's about having the right conversation with the customer and saying, we're always willing to continuously improve. Your business means something to us. And we're actually going to modify, change, add certain things in place so that we can do business with you, right? So it's having the vulnerable conversation with the customer, the client, and or your internal folks to say, hey, you want to know what? We may not be doing this now, but it's important for us, enough for us to put this into our program and start actioning toward it. And the customers, you know, I don't know if it's surprising or not, but in many instances, they're like, yeah, absolutely. We'll give you a roadmap so you can catch up, so you can do these things that we're requiring, and just come at it from a level of vulnerability. And that builds trust right there. Because who's gonna trust somebody who says they're perfect all the time?
No, I think I align with that, Jason. Yeah. I think I can think of specific instances where I've had conversations with customers. And I think if you come with humility and recognize that the person you're talking to is probably in the same situation you're in with other customers, right? And customers. And if you say to them, hey, you know, look, here's where we are, and here's where I can give you confidence that we're doing the right things. But just like you, we have things we need to improve on. And, you know, we're continually working on that improvement model and taking advice, suggestions, things we have to do to better improve the program based upon new intelligence, new threat research, new data. Look, I think that in every instance I've had that conversation, the customers come back and said, Yeah, I really appreciate that. And, you know, I'm happy to continue doing business with you because I can trust you.
That's it. Yep.
Yeah. Transparency and trust for sure. I mean, that's how you win those conversations. And by the way, there is a KPI tied to how many sales calls I'm on. So I'll take that as a compliment. In the second article, he talks about five examples of key metrics. Now, supposedly Gartner's published 20 to their clients that they track. Thoughts? We talked about one, risky third parties engaged. Thoughts on the other ones, Jason and Ben?
I mean, again, for me, they're good tactical items. I'm not, on a monthly basis, I'm not sitting in front of the CEO talking about time to remediate incidents. These are more tactical metrics that I would say I want to align to more strategic conversations, right? And say, this is how we achieved, you know, this strategic goal was by doing these tactical things well.
Or, you know, your leading and trailing indicators really should be fodder for a conversation and a path that you're trying to lay out, right? So when I look at phishing reporting rates, I don't know if that's really telling me a ton, right? Really, what's telling me a ton is, am I getting better or worse at something, and what am I doing to correct that behavior or activity? And so, you know, I really think it's super important to figure out what behavior are you in trying to incentivize or de-incentivize, and those metrics should align to those things and align to what you're programmatically trying to change. So vulnerabilities. I think it's just kind of pointless to report how many vulnerabilities you have. I think it's really important to report, you know, what's the average remediation time and how are you buying that down or how are you improving that? And if you're not, what are the things that you're seeing that are causing those problems? And so align and then figuring out a way to align that to why does the business care? If your vulnerability rate is getting worse, what's the impact to the business over that? And how do you articulate that value either in a positive or negative way back to the business so they can see, oh yeah, we need to do something about that.
Yeah, the two out of this five that I felt were the most strategic metrics to report to the board was risky third parties, only because there's a potential risk to downtime or business interruption or a data breach because of those relationships. And you could tie that into a risk discussion that the board would care about. The second one was recovery testing and, you know, do I have critical systems that are resilient and can be restored in the event of downtime or a breach or an attack or something like that? Again, because that to me ties to aspects of risk from a financial reputational perspective. Those two seem to be the most aligned. The other one seemed a little too tactical for me.
Yeah. But even still, right? Typically what I like to do from a business unit strategy is always align my strategic plan to my upper level business initiatives that the entire company is driving toward, right? So for example, if three of those are drive revenue, client satisfaction, and employee satisfaction, how do all those things align with those major pillars, right? So recovery testing, that definitely is driving revenue if your systems are, you know, making money for you. It's definitely client satisfaction if you're servicing your customers off of those. It's definitely employee satisfaction if your employees are using those systems. So, you know, align it to those higher level business goals that you're trying to achieve. And if, you know, if we have an outage because we're not testing, it's going to reduce revenue numbers, right? It's going to reduce client satisfaction numbers. It's going to affect those adversely.
But that's why it's really important to understand your business, right? And so if you have had outages or you've had recovery issues in the past that have caused, you know, issues from a customer perspective, then that metric could be easily tied back to, you know, a loss or, you know, an affectation of the revenue stream that you could report on and then use that for, you know, 12 months, 18 months, 24 months to track how you've improved that and then alter that metric, you know, after you've managed that, you're still tracking it internally, but you're not going to highlight that to the board if it's happening as intended. What you'd want to do is pivot to some metric that, as Jason said, would align to some, you know, some benefit that you're experiencing because of the program or some negative impact that you're trying to solve for. And so I think that's really the most important thing is understand the business and understand how the metric aligns to the business.
Yeah. Well, that comes into Article 3 with the litigation risks, right? Again, lining these risks into the business side, right? Because when you look at these, I mean, these are potential areas where, you know, the organization could fall under a lawsuit, either as a company or an individual, because the section on CISOs under fire, right? There are some CISOs that are being named as part of some of these data breach lawsuits, which is not good for the person at the end of the day either.
Right.
Yeah.
No, 100% agree.
I was going to say, I know both of these individuals, right? And it's personally affecting when something like this happens and you come under fire for it. And I think it's something anybody, you know, who's going after that role of a CISO needs to recognize that this is now something that potentially could happen. You need to think about that in your negotiations when you're looking at that new role, right? How are That's you right. covered by, you know, by insurance for that? What's the indemnification? Like all those things, you know, if you're going to be let go, are you going to be let go for cause? Then like, what's the result of that for you from a financial impact if you had no fault? I think all these things are things that people really need to start thinking about. And again, it's a highlight. I think we'll talk about it later. You know, the CISO role being pushed up into the, you know, into that C-suite, really as a C-suite member, you've got those C-suite responsibilities now as well. It's not just the, you've got a seat at the table, but you potentially have a target on your back in some instances too.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, one of the things I was going to say is make sure that you have some level of that director's protection, right? That director, officer and director liability protection and insurance when you're taking a role like this. That's one of those safeguards that you have as a leader that you can take advantage of, because, you know, last thing you want is to be liable for, a personal lawsuit against you. So,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, these are just new challenges that CISOs have to be cognizant of, that, you know, personally could be named in a lawsuit like that.
At the end of the day, guys, we've been begging and crawling and scratching for that seat at the table. This is what comes with the seat at the table.
Yeah.
That's part of the reality. Yep. I mean, these are things CFOs have been talking about for a lifetime.
Yeah, you're right. Next article, we got two back-to-back on the SEC. The first one, the second one's really interesting. The first one talks about what considers a material breach when it comes to reporting a cybersecurity incident to the SEC. And I remember in my consulting days, this first one hits me hard. Incidents violating a company's security policies or procedures, or that expose a company to liability. In my early days of consulting, I remember these huge security policies. They were gigantic. I mean, they threw everything in there. And when
it's like
I was
reading a EULA, it's like when you're reading a EULA, right?
Exactly right. And I said, by the way, as soon as you make this a corporate policy, you now need to comply with everything you put in that policy, everything. Which means right. Every auditor is going to come in and ask you, how are you doing each of these? So be careful what you put in your policy, because now a violation of that policy or procedure is now potentially a materially reportable offense up to the SEC as part of this new SEC requirement. I would not make my cybersecurity policies overly large. Just saying.
Keep it simple, stupid. At the end of the day, there's, you know, this is the blessing and the curse that's coming down the pipeline. You know, part of this is a blessing that these new rules are going to help heighten security programs and give a little bit of juice to security programs, but it's also going to put a microscope on security programs.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, you need to think about when you're writing a policy, the separation between, you know, policy, and requirements, right? Like there are differences in how you implement those things and how you write them up. But certainly, I mean, if you haven't been under intensive or large audit departments before, then yeah, you really need to make sure of what you put in there before they come back and ask you how you're doing it. You don't have any documentation or evidence to support that.
Yeah, and hey, by the way, partner with your legal team when you're developing these. Just putting it out there.
Yeah, I mean, these other ones make a lot of sense, right? It could impact the financials for the business. It could impact delivery of product. Those all make sense because they have a potentially a financial material component to it. In this materiality around the finance side from Sarbanes-Oxley is going to get applied to cybersecurity, it looks like here as well. But, you know, those are like, yeah, those make sense. But when you think about, oh, I didn't think about just a violation of my policy, I now have to report that to the SEC. That just changes your whole reporting, requirements as a CISO to your regulator, which I don't think a lot of organizations want to take on.
Well, so, and make sure you're, if any of these, if you think any of these are occurring, whether you're making the judgment or not, involves your CFO and legal, right? Mm-hmm. Make sure you're involving them in that discussion, because if they ultimately say we don't believe it is, then you know they're making the judgment call based upon that, and that's your error cover, right? If you're just making that decision and not weighing in on it with anybody else, you're burdening yourself with that.
Shame on you.
That decision, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. I mean, that is not one of those decisions you want to make in a vacuum at all.
This is a team sport.
Yep.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ben brought this article up earlier in the week. It's a great article. Sarbanes-Oxley is 20 years old, and now the SEC is proposing a new rule change to make cybersecurity experience required in the boardroom. Very interesting article. I mean, for anybody that lived through the Enron and the MCI financial issues and understand the roots of Sarbanes-Oxley from a financial perspective, they're taking a similar stance here in some respects and saying, well, just like you need somebody respond, the board needs to have understanding of financial impact. Now the board has to have an understanding of cybersecurity impact. And so they're looking to propose this rule for all public companies to have these folks on the board. And it's interesting, Ben, what I thought was interesting is their definition of expertise, right? Because it's not just title. It's not, you don't have to be a CISO, but you need to have cybersecurity experience in your history, in your past.
Yeah. So the nuance here for me, which I, you know, look, I'm not a fan of regulation in general, right? I think hopefully we could do things the right way without having to require regulation. But unfortunately, sometimes you just need it. And I think this is one case where it's just come to a head with too many issues and we need to start thinking about it. But I think the nuance here versus SOX is, as I read it, they're not actually requiring experience. What they're saying is the board has to disclose what experience they have. So, you know, you could, as a board under this regulation, as I read it, say, we don't have any experience. That'd probably be bad from a shareholder perspective, right? Mm-hmm. But at least they're requiring that alliteration of what is the experience? Is it, you know, do you have certifications? Have you actually sat, you know, butt in seat and actually done the job? What's the background? And so if you articulate that, I think hopefully that's something shareholders can really start looking into now and saying, wow, I didn't realize like we didn't really have somebody on the board with any experience. And this is the top level risk that the company's expressing in their annual statement.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. Because I mean, we've been talking about this for a while as a, you know, a mandate, that there are conversations around mandating a cybersecurity expert to the board. I mean, Ben, I'd really love to get your opinion on this. Do you think a mandate would be necessary, or you think it's enough pressure to have to publicly disclose that you have no cybersecurity expertise on your board? I don't know. I'm weighing it in my head right now on the fly, and I'm like, which would be more pressure?
Yeah, no, I ride the fence on that, right? I mean, part of me says, look, you need to require it because otherwise people aren't going to do it. But I mean, geez, if you're an institutional investor and you get back a report and it says that, hey, we've got one guy and he took the CISP that didn't pass, like, what? how is that, you know, related experience, and how does that meet our due diligence? Like that, I mean, I guess it leaves the shareholders holding the bag for not requiring.
That's what I was just going to say. Now it's on the appetite of the shareholder. If they even look at that line in the report that says, sorry, we don't have anybody.
But then I think if there was a breach or material incidents and the shareholders came back and sued and the board could state they didn't require it, right? Like, I guess it loses water in the suit. So it will just be really interesting to see how, from an applicability side, like this actually goes into effect. Now, everybody seems to be reading this as it's going to be a sea change and you're going to start needing to see people participate and be required on boards. I don't know. I haven't necessarily heard the uptick and seen the traction of a big change yet. So I don't know if they're waiting for this to pass or if really it is not, I don't know, doesn't have the teeth in it that it really should.
Yeah. Because the way I read the article and the way my brain clicked was, oh my God, this is going to force them to put a cybersecurity expert on the board. And then the way you articulated the article, Ben, made me go, holy shit, they may be able to get away with it.
Yeah, I know. That was my concern.
Yeah, my concern is if you leave it up to the shareholders, right, and they don't look at this, you know, what's the impact to them if something goes wrong? And to your point, if there's a lawsuit, like, where does the lawsuit go, right? The other option is you mandate it, just like you did in Sarbanes-Oxley, and you have that expertise, and then there's no excuses. I don't know which way works out better for the shareholders, because really at the end of the day, this should be about the shareholders' protection, right? And shareholders should have the data available to make the right investment decisions, and this should be one of those areas. But if they don't mandate it, then you leave it up to the shareholder to decide. I don't know that it will have much impact that way.
And it's kind of like an uneducated consumer, right? Like, everybody clicks through the EULA because you got no other choice, right?
So exactly.
I just don't know that, like, shareholders are going to sit up and be like, we don't have any expertise. We need somebody.
We need that cybersecurity stuff. But,
yeah. You got a cyber guy?
Yeah. I'm not sure we're there yet. Last article for the day before I have one final announcement. 10 skill sets for the leaders, right? We cover a lot of these at different times. It's a pretty good list of 10. Jason, you pulled out the one around vulnerability earlier. Mm-hmm. Empathy is in here, which we've talked a lot about on the show as well. Other things like curiosity and collaboration are on this list. You know, those soft skills that you need as a leader to help move an organization forward.
Yeah. Another one I think that will fare really well in conversation is the ability to tell stories. The ability to tell stories, I think, helps, you know, soften the blow of a technical conversation when you can put a story around it, right? Because we're always talking about don't get too far down the technical weeds when you're having a business conversation with, you know, business unit leaders. If you can wrap stories around initiatives or influence or items that you really want to move forward, I think that's a really, really good trait to have to kind of break down those barriers of the, you know, that technical, you know, or just a technical arm of the business, and really break down those walls.
Yeah, I think a lot of these actually fit into that, right? Like, if you're telling a story, you can articulate empathy, you can show, you know, the ability to promote collaboration, you can show trust and develop that trust within the org. So I think it's probably true. That's probably one of the most important ones in here. I loved in the word cloud there that soft skills was highlighted, because it's just so true. Like, undervalued component of the CISO role is having those soft skills. And if you don't have them, work on them. You need them.
Yep. 100%.
Yep. 100%. And talking about soft skills, it is with great remorse that this is the last episode with Johnny Blaze, as he's decided to move on from Security Weekly. Johnny, you've been here through a lot of change. I'd like to personally thank you for making Security Weekly the best produced podcast in the industry. You will truly be missed, and we wish you the best of luck. This is to you, buddy.
Cheers, my friend. Love you tons. Always here for you. I mean, just the experience that I've been here at Security Weekly, having you around always makes a smile, always brings quality to the table, and there'll be no other person I'd rather dance in Vegas with than you and our crew. So it was, it's been a great ride, my friend.
Yeah. I don't have the background that these guys do with you, but, thanks a lot. It's been my experience. You're very professional and, always great to work with you. So thanks a lot.
We're going to miss you, buddy.
Appreciate it. I'm going to miss you guys too. Thank you guys so much. I really do appreciate it. Thank you.
The show will go on as Goose takes the helm next week. So thank you, everyone, for joining us today. We'll see you next week on Business Security Weekly.